Hi everyone, good morning. It's really nice to be back in Philadelphia to speak. Always a pleasure to speak at Midrash Yom Rishon. So the topic that I thought we would discuss today, again the title I gave was Great Debates in Jewish History, Rabbis, Slavery, and the Civil War. So as we go through the different aspects, the different perspectives of it, I thought I'd just give a little bit of a brief introduction before we have a chance to look at some sources. So first of all, as we know, in the years leading up to the Civil War, one of the main issues was slavery. And what's interesting is Jews are really on both sides of the conflict. You had abolitionists in the north, you had supporters of slavery in the south, and you had a very wide range of opinions in the middle, which we'll have a chance to look at today as well. As we have a chance to look at different primary sources, we're going to look at different sermons and different articles that rabbis published in the years leading up to the Civil War, all about this topic of how they felt about slavery, what their opinions were. And what we'll see is we'll get a feel of the different arguments that rabbis made on both sides and how they used Torah sources to support their arguments. What's interesting also is we have a chance to go through each of these sources, and hopefully we'll do it in an interactive way, and I encourage everyone to participate. As we have a chance to look at these different aspects, we'll see how there are a lot of different issues that really affected the rabbinic attitudes of each person as they weighed in the conversation. This could be their background, it could be whether they were traditional, orthodox, or reform, it could be where they lived, were they in a state that supported the South, a state that supported the Union, was it a state that had strong economic ties to the South, and how that affected their attitude as well. And finally, what's also interesting is how some of them having a revolutionary background in Europe also affected or influenced their perspective and where they weighed in on this debate. So again, all of this we'll kind of see as we have a chance to look through some of these sources. A few other pieces of background information. So first of all, a lot of what we'll share today and what we'll discuss is based on a lot of different articles on this topic. So I gave you a further reading list at the back. So if you want to look into this yourself, you're welcome to. And a lot of what we'll say today is found in those articles. A few other points of interest before we kind of begin. One thing that's interesting is by this point in 1860, most people have already made their minds up about slavery, how they feel about the Civil War. So when we look at these articles, when we look at these sermons, it's not so much that the rabbis are shaping public opinion. Public opinion has already kind of been shaped. It's more that they're not the leaders in this case. I would say they're more kind of like the followers, and their opinion is just showing what public opinion was at this point. So it wasn't so much that it was shaping the debate, but more that it was representative of the opinions that were already out there in their respective Jewish communities. As well, something that's interesting is that there was no official chief rabbi of America at this time, which could lead to, there are positives of that, but there are also negatives of that. And again, what this means was there was no one voice that really spoke for American Jewry at this time. But where this gets into trouble, but we'll see with the opening source or how this whole kind of controversy over rabbinic attitudes towards slavery begins, is when one rabbi publishes an article that seems to present the, you know, American Jewry opinion on slavery, lots of other rabbis, lots of other people start to feel like, well, wait a second, we don't want the non-Jewish community thinking that this is how we feel. We don't want people thinking this is the official statement, so they start to respond in kind. So again, there wasn't any official response, just again, different rabbis as individuals or representative of their own communities presenting their opinion. And finally, just a point about the positions of the Jews in both the South and in the North. So again, Jews in the South, though some of them did own slaves, it wasn't a huge proportionate number. It didn't really affect the slave trade, even though a lot of them did, though some of them did own slaves. But one thing that's important to remember when we think about Jews in the South versus Jews in the North is if you live in the South, part of assimilating into Southern culture, unfortunately, what came along with that was a certain acceptance of slavery, a certain toleration of slavery. If you supported the South, if you were living in the South, if you were an assimilated Jew living in the South, part of that was that slavery was a part of life. And interesting also when you think about classes, unfortunately the fact that, especially in the South, the black community was seen as on a lower level, this gave Jews a little bit more of an advantage. They were kind of in a higher class. So again, this was something that promoted or perhaps for Jews in the South to support slavery a little bit more. As opposed to Jews in the North didn't really have a distinction. In the North, there was a little bit more distrust. They were seen as immigrant outsiders, and they faced a little bit more kind of persecution. So again, where you lived, not just straight North versus South, but even the states in the middle, we'll see how this affected their opinions. Just again, going into it. So that's a little bit of background information. Now I'll have a chance to look at the sources as well. So as we go through it, first of all, just to give
a little bit of a framework of how everything kind of happened. When did people start speaking about this? What exactly took place? So in December 1860, President Buchanan called upon all denominations to observe a day of fasting and prayer to preserve the Union. It was a day of tefillah for everyone, of all denominations, to really come together and speak about this topic and to pray for whatever we could do to prevent, you know, this catastrophe from happening and the Union from separating. So in steps, Rabbi Morris Raphael, who was a rabbi who originally had been born in Sweden, he goes from Germany to England, finally arriving in New York, being the rabbi of the Bnei Yeshurun Synagogue in New York. He was an Orthodox rabbi. And he basically gives a sermon on the biblical view of slavery. After he gives it, it's published in local papers, and this seems to create a huge controversy. It's seen, at least by others, that his sermon entitled The Biblical View on Slavery seemed to support slavery, as we have a chance to read it together. I'll throw that question out to you to see whether or not we do feel if it actually supports slavery or not. This causes a big controversy and invites responses from lots of other rabbis as well. So this is one of the kind of the opening act of this kind of controversy, which we'll have a chance to unpack, and then we'll see what other rabbinic views were as well. Okay, so this is basically the first source in the source packet. I gave kind of excerpts from the sermon. It was very long. So as we go through these excerpts, we'll have a chance to read it and discuss and just to think about what exactly are the arguments he is making. Is he defending slavery? Is he not? What seems to be affecting his opinion or influencing it? What seems surprising to us? So as we have a chance to read it and go through, I invite you to think about those questions. Then we'll have a chance to share our opinions as well. Okay, so we'll start with source number one. We're actually going to start with the second paragraph, where again, he says that he's going to try to address this question of biblical view of slavery in the Bible, and he's speaking again in 1861. So in the second paragraph, he says the following. He says, having thus traced slavery back to the remotest period, I next request our attention to the question, is slaveholding a sin in sacred scripture? Is it a sin to own slaves? Even on that most solemn, most holy occasion, slaveholding is not only recognized and sanctioned as an integral part of the social structure, when it is commanded that the Sabbath of the Lord is to bring rest to Avdecha Vamatecha, your male slave and your female slave. So his first point when he's addressing slavery is that when we think about, you know, the laws of Shabbat or what we say about Shabbat, when it comes to slavery, what is his point? And feel free to make this interactive. What seems to be the... Yeah?
That your male slave, your female slave are included in those who are part of what we commemorate, that we rest, and so they're part of it. They're not like extra servants that you work harder because you rest.
Mm-hmm. Right, very nice. So there seems to be this institution, right, that exists of slavery, that if it's telling us that our servants have to rest, then it's something that exists, something that must be sanctioned. Yes?
We should continue that pasuk. Next one is bamtecha.
Okay.
So, which means, just like the animals, also slaves should have rest on Shabbat.
Right. And again, this whole idea here is he's saying that, you know, and it's something that, you know, we see in Tanakh, that definitely slavery did exist. And he's responding again to people who are saying, you know, times have changed, slavery doesn't, you know, slavery shouldn't be something that's sanctioned anymore. And he's saying, if you look in Tanakh, this is something that exists. Slaves exist. We allow them to rest, right? But slavery is an institution that should be sanctioned. Then he continues to address specific claims or specific arguments people are making, saying that, you know, really the Bible would be against slavery. And we'll see what he says in the next paragraph. How dare you, in the face of the sanction and protection afforded to slave property in the Ten Commandments, how dare you denounce slaveholding as a sin? When you remember that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Job, the men with whom the Almighty conversed, with whose names he emphatically connects his own most holy name, and to whom he vouchsafed to give the character of perfect, upright, fearing God, and eschewing evil, that all these men were slaveholders. Does it not strike you that you were guilty of something very little short of blasphemy? And if you answer me, oh, in their time, slaveholding was lawful, but now has become sin. I, in my turn, ask you, when and by what authority you draw the line? Tell us the precise time when slaveholding ceased to be permitted and became sinful. Thoughts on this paragraph? What seems to be, what direction is he taking the argument now? What seems to be his objections to these claims against slavery?
Well,
any thoughts?
He's saying, don't suggest that now suddenly something changed. Where is the cutoff line between that it was permitted, that it's not? And basically he says there's no such cutoff line.
Very good, right? So on one hand, how can we say that slavery is now is now is something that doesn't we don't want to allow anymore. When, at what point do we draw a line and say that times have changed? This is no longer permitted. Where does this come from? Very good. And then we see also right at the beginning, he's saying how if you say that slaveholding is a sin, who are you basically calling a sinner? Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. How can you say that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were sinners, right? If they held slaves, you know, again, it's something that people we see, we hold to a very high level. How could you accuse the Avot of such a thing? So on one hand, he's kind of making these dual arguments here. On one hand, you know, how could we call the Avot sinners if this is what you're doing, if you're saying that slavery is a sin? At the same time, this argument that times have changed, and therefore, you know, times have changed, we have to adapt certain laws in the Torah, who are we to come and say that? Where exactly do we draw the line to say that now, oh, at this point, now slavery is not allowed anymore, slavery is forbidden. So what's interesting here is I think we see here a little bit of the polemic that was going on at the time, a little bit between Orthodox and Reform, right? Because again, we'll see kind of in the arguments that are given against him, but he almost seems to box it into a little bit of a corner, right? Because at the same time, once you start saying times have changed, you know, laws have changed, this is something that, you know, people could argue back. Well, wait a second, then where do we draw the line for anything? If you start saying that about slavery, perhaps you could say that about using an organ in a temple, right? Or about, you know, driving on Shabbat or different things like that, obviously later on. But where exactly do you draw that line? And here, again, I think we'll see the Orthodox traditional Reform approach that how exactly, especially here, he seems to be in a little bit of a difficult position. On one hand, you know, you don't want to sanction slavery. At the same time, you don't want to be starting to say that times have changed and therefore the halachot have changed. And again, that's something that he's going to want to avoid over here. So again, these are kind of the arguments he's making so far. And we're going to see another argument that he throws in to the mix as well. So we'll keep reading. When we remember the mischief with this inventing a new sin, not knowing the Bible is causing, how it has exasperated the feelings of the South and alarmed the conscience of the North to a degree that men who should be brothers are on the point of imbruing their hands in each other's blood, are we not entitled to ask, what right have you to insult and exasperate thousands of God-fearing, law-abiding citizens whose moral worth and patriotism, whose purity of conscience and of life are equal to your own? So again, now he kind of takes us in a little bit of a different direction, that on one hand, it's bad enough that people are coming to accuse the Avots of being sinners, and they're taking it to such an extreme. But at the same time, once you are accusing the South of basically being sinners, and again, saying that slavery is wrong, you're going to cause a situation where we're going to go to war. And one thing that we'll see over and over with the different sources as we go through the packet is there was this tremendous fear, especially on the side of the rabbis, or especially in the Jewish community, that if this came to a civil war, and if, let's say, you know, God forbid, the Union was destroyed, what would happen to the Jewish community? And there was a tremendous appreciation the Jewish community had for the liberties in America that they had nowhere else. Especially, we'll see this after with rabbis who came from revolutionary backgrounds in Europe who had seen the anti-Semitism that existed in Europe, and they had seen this idea that you come to this new land where all of a sudden you're given full rights, and this is something that has to be preserved no matter what. And we'll see this tremendous, tremendous fear that even taken to an extreme later on with rabbis who will say, you know, that slavery is something horrible, but if it's slavery versus losing this democracy where Jews are given full rights, it's a little bit of a hard decision to make whether we're willing to go to war over slavery and lose this utopia, this great society where Jews are given rights in this democracy. So here too, we see this a little bit on a lesser scale, but he's saying that are you really willing to call the entire South sinners to the extent that it's going to come to war, where you're going to have brother fighting brother? Is this something that you really want? So again, it's kind of fear of where is this going to lead? And also this tremendous distrust that certain, not just rabbis, but certain, you know, people had for the abolitionists. There was a lot of kind of skepticism as to their motives. Who were they linked to? Were they linked to, you know, certain Protestant ministers that had certain anti-Semitic leanings? You know, were the abolitionists really, you know, to use, you know, different terms like lishma, or were they just trying to start fights? And where exactly is this going to lead? And there was this tremendous kind of distrust going on with what are their motivations, and are we really willing to go to war over this? However, he does kind of roll it back a little bit in the next few paragraphs, and he doesn't want people to think that he is 100% sanctioning slavery or what is going on in the South. And he says, I'm still sorry to find that I'm delivering a pro-slavery discourse. I'm no friend to slavery, and still less friendly to the practical workings of slavery. But I stand here as a teacher in Israel not to place before you my own feelings and opinions, but to propound to you the word of God, the Bible view of slavery. And the next few paragraphs, he gives kind of a distinction between the different types of slaves we find in Tanakh, which would be the Eved Ivri and the Eved Kanani, right? The Jewish slave and the non-Jewish slave. And he says that if you think about the condition of the Jewish slave or the Eved Ivri in Tanakh, and I can throw this out as a question, what do we know about the condition of the Eved Ivri in Tanakh, certain laws or restrictions that might show it in a more, again, we're not sanctioning slavery here, but might show it in a light that seems to show, let's say, certain values or certain ethics surrounding slavery. Any thoughts as to things? Yes?
Well, it says in the Torah, Misha Kanala Eved Kanala Baal, that if you have one pillow, it goes to the slave.
Right. Right, excellent. We'll see that quote actually later on, right? That anyone who's acquired a slave is considered as if they've acquired a master because of all the restrictions that kind of exist on how you must treat a slave. Very good. Anyone else? Any other thoughts?
Yeah, you have to feed them before you feed yourself.
Very good, right.
They sometimes have more rights than you do.
Right, right. And they have to be treated in a certain way. It definitely sounds very different, right, than what's going on in the South. Yeah?
Maybe he gets to it later, but to me, the main crux of the question is not so much whether the Torah allows for it, but it's the how to treat, and that and I can understand it's very complex, especially being in a host country as you described, but if we're already embracing or have to tolerate slavery, it's more about what are the terms of the slave, like everything else,
right.
What are the terms of it, and that the Torah actually did not allow for the mistreating.
Right.
And that was really the point of it. But a lot of times we get bound up in, I'll call it a broader question, which derails us.
For sure. No, and that's a great point. So if we actually turn the page over, we'll see in the continuation of his speech. So he goes on not so much a tangent, but he goes on an explanation of everything kind of as people shared, right? The laws of an Eved Ivri, how an Eved Ivri can't be a slave forever, right? The slavery caps at a certain year. The idea that as people shared, right? If you says it's here in English, right? If you buy a Hebrew bondsman, you get a master, right? That the Rambam says. And he says, and I put this quote in bold, the bottom of the first paragraph in the second page. In fact, between the Hebrew bondsman and the southern slave, there is no point of resemblance. And he goes on in the next paragraph to say, the slave is a person in whom the dignity of human nature is to be respected. He has rights. While the heathen view of slavery, which prevailed in Rome, and which I'm sorry to say is adopted in the South, reduces the slave to a thing. And a thing can have no rights. And it's interesting here that as he kind of brings it together, as he tries to, you know, wrap up his sermon, the argument he seems to be making is that is slavery allowed according to Tanakh? His answer is yes. However, what is going on in the South? Is what is happening in the South to the level of how the Tanakh or how the Bible would view slavery? His answer is no. And really, we see here almost two things that he's trying to say. Number one, that, you know, what is happening in the South is definitely not what the Torah would sanction. The people in the South have to kind of improve their level of slavery. They could bring it to the extent of how Eved Ivri or that institution was being treated, that would be a different story, but it's not. But at the same time, what's going on in the North to accuse the South of being sinners just because they own slaves and saying that that's something that the Bible would not sanction, he believes is false. And just to show you the last paragraph, the second last paragraph, this comes with tremendous fear of going to war and losing the Union. He suggests that basically both sides have to kind of calm down a little bit. And he says, right, if our northern fellow citizens, content with following the word of God, would not insist on being righteous overmuch or denouncing sin, which the Bible knows not, they would entertain more equity and less ill feeling towards their southern brethren. And if our southern fellow citizens would adopt the Bible view of slavery and discard the heathen slave code, which permits a few bad men to indulge in abuse of power that throws a disgrace on the whole body of slaveholders, if both north and south would do what is right, then God would mercifully avert the impending evil, and hopefully, he says it right, and avert the calamity of civil war from our midst. So the North has to stop calling the South sinners, the South has to just take on the institution of Eved Ivri, everyone will avoid war, and everything will be well in the world. So that seems to be his points, and I'm interested to hear if anyone has reactions. Is this something that seems like an actual description of what's going on? Is this plausible or not? Yes.
I think it's disingenuous because the blacks in the South were slaves, were clearly, by the biblical account, Eved Kanani, not Eved Ivri. And the treatment from Eved Kanani is much less than Eved Ivri, and he is brushes it aside. That's mm-hmm. not really what Judaism says.
Right, right. And I think that's an interesting point also. There seems to be a lot of kind of whitewashing going on when he ignores the whole institution of Eved Kanani. And Eved Kanani in the Torah do not have rights, right? They don't, again, where,
much,
you know,
much,
yeah,
much,
they have some rights, right, but much, much less than Eved Ivri. And to say, and again, right, he seems to kind of be ignoring that whole aspect of Eved Kanani, which wouldn't really support his thesis that, oh, if you hold to the biblical view of Tanakh's view of slavery, everything will be fine, you'll be held to kind of a higher level. So he kind of leaves that out. Yes?
Well, I don't think it's... I don't think we can criticize that so much because he's talking about... The Torah is talking to Jewish people about Eved Kanani and Eved Ivri. The American South is not a Jewish society. It's not a... It's not B'nai Yisrael.
Yeah.
It's just people. So... The idea that any of it applies is a little bogus, but
right.
how to parse it out is not clear at all between Eved Kanani and Eved Ivri.
For sure, right, and how he's trying to apply this system onto, you know, what he sees in the Torah, onto what's happening south, right? Is it something that can even connect or not is a good point. Yeah.
So, point one, I don't know that blacks should be considered Kanani. And what the Torah talks about is the Imam that lived in Israel might have a different status. Might, I'm not learned enough to say this, but I would ask the question whether a black or anybody else who's not Jewish should be considered in the same category mm-hmm. as Umat as the Umat in Israel. As far as the, you know, whether he can take the values of the Torah for Eved Ivri, Eved Kanani, and talk about the South, perhaps what he was trying to do was to talk about how the Torah looks at slaves in general, and that they were, whether it was Eved Ivri or Kanani, they were certainly treated better than with the dignity of human beings that the Southern slaves were not treated. I will say this, that there was once somebody here in Philadelphia who was, I think, fourth generation from a Southern family, and his family did have slaves, and mm-hmm. he said that he was told that his great-grandfather followed the laws of the Torah in terms of how he treated the slaves. Now, I was too young to say, oh, did he get upset that it was an Eved Kanani, or what kind of Eved was it? But I do remember that he was very proud that family followed.
Interesting. No, thank you for sharing. So it's interesting, again, as we kind of wrap up this source and see the responses that it engenders, that in general, most scholars seem to say that Raphael didn't really understand how terrible slavery was in the South. Like, he just didn't really understand what was going on, what was the reality, and if he'd really understood that reality, it would have been hard for him to make the arguments that he did. That was just, again, not really understanding how terrible and what the condition was in which slaves lived in the South. What's interesting is once the war breaks out, he actually does side with the Union. His son gets injured fighting for the Union. So again, once the war breaks out, he does side with the North. But again, it's interesting just to see this, how this sermon comes through. How, even though I think we've seen that he doesn't exactly seem to sanction slavery, there was this fear after he gave it and it was published in local newspapers that, you know, he was supporting slavery, and this prompted different responses. People had felt they had to step up on behalf of the Jewish community almost to prevent like a Chilul Hashem, and to say this is not what we believe, this is not the opinion, and we'll see these sources next. Yeah.
I think that we have to put it in historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
United States did not have rabbis. The first rabbi came somewhere in 1840.
Right.
Only 20 years, 15 years before him. And a Reform Judaism started in Germany in 1810. And they already have inroads in the United States. He is seeing two issues that he has to deal with. Issue of slavery versus non-slavery, and issue of orthodoxy versus reform.
Yeah.
And he is trying now to wiggle out somehow that the orthodoxy looks okay. This is just as much on his plate, and he's addressing it between the lines as much as the issue of slavery.
Right. No, 100%. And that's also going back to that point before where he's very nervous about saying the times have changed, because what's that going to say vis-a-vis orthodox versus reform? So great. Okay, so let's see some of the responses. So one of the main responses that is given to Raphael's article, Raphael's sermon, is from Michael Halperin, who is a Reformed Jewish scholar. He's a linguist and editor, and he publishes an editorial in the New York Tribune where he says the following. So it's interesting just to see what his responses are. He does not he does not mince words here in his thoughts about Raphael's speech. This is in source number two. He starts off and he says, "Must the stigma of Egyptian principles be fastened on the people of Israel by Israelish lips themselves? Right? How could it be that the people who came out of Mitzrayim are going to be the ones who say that, you know, they support slavery? Lastly, there is nothing sufficient to fasten the reproach of Egypt on the law of the great fugitive slave who inaugurated his divine mission as liberator of a people of slaves by slaying one of their overseers, and who would end his career repeated over and over again, 'Forget not that ye have been slaves in Egypt.'" So again, how could it be that someone says the Torah supports slavery? Moshe Rabbeinu was the ultimate person who redeemed the slaves, right? Who fought to free slaves from Egypt. How could it be that you put almost in the words of Moshe this idea that we would support slavery? So again, this very heated response. Let me turn the page also. And here we see what's interesting, kind of going back to the debate between, you know, Orthodox and Reformed. Do we say that times have changed, that halacha has changed? We start to see his response, which even though, again, it's coming from Reform, I think it's interesting to think to see it in the context of today when we think about different issues or other issues in the Gemara, that this is something that, again, it is used also in Orthodox for different approaches. So when exactly do we say, are there cases where we do say times have changed and the Torah adapts, or there are times where we say nothing has changed at all? So he says over here, the top of the third page, "And they know that much was yielded by the law of Moses, the stubborn passions of man, of his people, of freed slaves, and of his time. You know that Talmudic lo dibra Torah keneged yetzer hara. The law does not ignore the evil instinct." And this argument as well that, wait a second, maybe it could be that, you know, again, how do we view slavery, the Torah? Is this something that everyone has to have? Is it something that is tolerated? Is it something perhaps in the category we'll see in the next rabbi who talks as well? Is this in the case of maybe the Goel Hadam, capital punishment, Eshet Yifat Torah, different things that there was kind of rabbinic restrictions added on in order to kind of limit certain things at different times? So how exactly do we view this? Is it something that is sanctioned, or is it something that was kind of supposed to be phased out, or wasn't seen as lechatchila, wasn't seen as ideal? So again, this is Halperin's kind of reaction. What's interesting also, different scholars point out that he came from a revolutionary background in Hungary, and this also kind of pushed him a little bit in the direction of being an abolitionist, that he was someone who felt, you know, revolution is not a bad thing sometimes if you do it in the right way for the right cause, which we'll see again. Something that's tempered by other responses who say, no, how could Jews risk losing what we have in America over slavery, over revolution?
He was a reformer, correct?
Yes, yes. So moving on. So that was Halperin. The other big response to Raphael was Rabbi David Einhorn, who was a reform rabbi. He starts off in Baltimore. He actually ends up here in Philadelphia. We'll talk about him now. And he writes a more detailed response to Raphael. He publishes four articles in the Sinai Journal. He was a staunch abolitionist, very much outspoken against slavery. And he brings, and again, he's coming from a Reformed perspective, but he shared the following. And it's interesting, again, to see where he's coming from and the arguments that he's making. So he starts off to say, the question exclusively to be decided is whether Scripture merely tolerates this institution as an evil not to be disregarded, and therefore infuses in its legislation a mild spirit gradually to lead to its dissolution, whether it favors, approves of, and justifies and sanctions it in its moral aspect. Almost like, is this lechatchila or is this bidyeved? How are we supposed to view this different aspect of slavery in Tanakh? So he goes through, different examples, and he gives examples also of, again, different things we had said in Tanakh, and we'll give one of the examples also. He talks about polygamy, different things that, you know, at one time were sanctioned in Tanakh, but later on were kind of overridden. And we'll say over here, he says, we'll go to the bold part in the middle. Is a justification of institution, the immorality of which Dr. Raphael will scarcely deny, and whose propagation Rabbeinu Gershon sought to check through a ban, here he's talking about polygamy, not here affirmed in the most positive manner. With all the hollow clamor about the rationalism of our day, it must be conceded that the Mosaic law, as in the case of blood vengeance and the marriage of a war prisoner, right, Eshet Yifat Torah, Goel Hadam, here merely tolerated the institution in view of once existing deeply rooted social conditions, or more correctly, evils, and recognize it in reference to civil rights, but never approved or considered it pleasing in the sight of God. So again, this idea that, you know, this argument that, again, is coming from a reform perspective, but it's something that you can see existing in certain elements in the Gemara or in Chazal, especially when it comes to Eshet Yifat Torah, Lo Dibra Torah Keneged Ben Adam, or even the idea of polygamy. that gets taken out, right? Rabbeinu Gershon with a takana. Are there certain institutions that we see, or even when it comes to capital punishment or Goel Hadam, that Masachet Makot, Chazal, you know, again, talks about Masachet Makot, Rabbi Kiva and Ritarfron say, you know, if they had lived in a time period where there had been capital punishment, they would have asked as many questions as they could in order to kind of, through a technicality, allow the witnesses to, you know, the case to kind of fall apart, so they wouldn't have to come and take someone's life, and they wouldn't have to come and execute someone. So we do see different examples where this argument is used. But here, I think, as we see before, especially with this polemic between Orthodox and Reform, there's almost a hesitation in the Orthodox to use this argument then. Even though I think it's interesting if you think about, and we'll see an argument later on, the last source from Rabbi Jonathan Sachs today, it's interesting kind of, I think, if you ask, you know, what the Orthodox perspective is on slavery in the Bible today, this is kind of the argument you might get. But back in this day, this was considered more of a reform argument because there was a lot of nervousness about giving in to any type of, you know, times change, halakha has changed. And he goes on in the third paragraph, and he says, right, a book which Seth talks about being created B'Tzelem Elohim, the other values that we see in Tanakh and Chumash, a book which sets up this principle and at the same time says that all human beings are descended from the same human parents can never approve slavery and have it find favor in the sight of God. If we turn the page over, here he talks, and I think this goes back to this question before about, is it worth going to war over slavery or not? And Rabbi Einhorn was someone who, again, came from, you know, he was very influenced by the Aquinas scholars, he was very influenced by the revolutions taking place in Europe, and he still very much, though, appreciated what the Jewish community had in America. However, different than the opinions who thought, you know, the most important thing is to preserve the union so the Jewish community can be safe, and if that means we have to tolerate slavery, we have to tolerate slavery. Rabbi Einhorn has an opposite perspective. And his is that as much as we want to preserve the Jewish community's special status in America where we have freedom, you can only ensure that Jews are safe if all minorities are safe. And for him, he felt that if the position of slavery still existed in the United States, there was no way to guarantee that Jews would be able to maintain their civil rights. And how would we be able to know that this wouldn't lead to more restrictions in the Jewish community? And the only way for us to really be free is if all people are free in America. And for that, it's worth going to war, even if this means risking the union. He says over here, the Jew has special cause to be conservative, and he is doubly and triply so in a country which grants him all the spiritual and material privileges he can wish for. He wants peace at every price and trembles for the preservation of the union like a true son for the life of a dangerously sick mother. But at the same time, as much as he says this, you know, slavery is something that for him is, you know, that's the red line. For that, it's worth going to war over, and this is something that we cannot sanction. What's interesting about Rabbi Einhorn in this case is he writes this article. So he at that point was in Baltimore, and in Baltimore you had different types of Jews and Jewish community. You had the older German elite, who had strong economic ties to the South, and then you had he came from kind of the younger German immigrant group, which again were kind of more on the abolitionist side. But what was interesting was after he, you know, wrote these editorials, you know, saying that slavery was wrong and coming out against Raphael, the older community was not so happy with that he was coming out against slavery in Baltimore. They actually burned down his publications office in Baltimore, and he basically ran away to Philadelphia, and he had to kind of come here to be safe. And basically, in Baltimore, they reached out and they told him, you know, you can come back to Baltimore, it's fine, we're fine when you're coming back, but you're not allowed to speak about anything inflammatory, no politics. And given the choice between returning to Baltimore and not being allowed to speak about politics and staying in Philadelphia, he decided to stay in Philadelphia. So again, I guess here people are more okay with talking about politics, and we'll see later on, not so much, we talk about another Philadelphia rabbi. But again, that seemed to be his approach. There's one more thing we see from Rabbi Einhorn, source 4. So now he is speaking in congregation in Knesset Israel in Philadelphia, and he says, again, like now mincing words, is it anything else but a deed of Amalek, rebellion against God to enslave beings created in his image? And again, you're going to, I would say, looking for parallel ethics found in the Torah, that even though the Torah may have seemed to sanction slavery at one point, we also have these other values, these other internal ethics about Tzelem Elohim, almost this idea of Amalek, and associating having slaves with Amalek.
He's also using one false argument, and he knew that the argument is false, so that's polygamy. Half the Jews still observe polygamy in the Yemen, in Iraq, etc., etc. Even Israel, polygamy in certain cases is legal even today. So what I'm saying is polygamy is not an argument, and he knew it's not an argument. Mm-hmm. So for the case of winning the case, he's using stuff that he knows is not correct.
Interesting. I hear that. I hear that polygamy might be something that... But I think at that point in America, even with the Sephardi community, you didn't really have anyone who had, you know, multiple wives, right? No, right, true. But I guess in the American Jewish community. But I hear that also, right? That, like, even certain things, saying that times have changed, we've outlawed it, depends on the different... how different communities might react. So, yeah, that's an interesting perspective. Okay, so that's about Rabbi Einhorn. Moving on, I want to show kind of a few other rabbis that... shared, again, we saw kind of the abolitionist, the northern kind of approach. We'll talk a little bit about the southern, then we'll see the opinion in the middle. So Rabbi Bernard Ilawi, which is source number 5, he was an Orthodox rabbi in Baltimore, and he was someone who, again, didn't mince words, but in the opposite direction. He was someone who, again, I don't think we could say, I think a lot of times when it comes down to supporting slavery, people really didn't understand what was going on in the South. But it was more for them this idea that if you live in the South, if you have strong economic ties to the South, in Baltimore, he was connected very much to the older German elite, right, who had economic ties. There was this distrust, there was this tremendous distrust of the abolitionists and how they were warmongering, they were starting fights. There was this idea that we don't want to go into civil war. There was this idea also of Southern pride, that Southern states should be able to make their own decisions. And again, I think it's a little bit separate from, you know, seeing how people were actually treated in the South. And he says the following, right, who can blame our brethren of the South for seceding from a society whose government cannot or will not protect the property rights and privileges of a great portion of the Union against the encroachments of a majority misguided by some influential, ambitious aspirants and selfish politicians? And again, this total mistrust of kind of people who are starting this war, of the abolitionists in the North. He then kind of piggybacks a little bit off of Raphael's arguments in Tanakh, and he says, you know, he talks about this idea of Moshe, and he says, you know, if Moshe was someone who was so, you know, against slavery, why do we see slavery again mentioned or almost sanctioned Tanakh the second they got to Israel, right? He says over here, you know, it's not bolder, right? Why did not Moses, who, as it to be seen from his code, was not in favor of slavery, command the judges in Israel to interfere with the institutions of those nations who lived under their jurisdiction to make their slaves free, or to take forcibly away a slave from master as soon as he tries to free soil their country? Why didn't Moshe command them as they, you know, are they going towards Canaan to free all the slaves as they pass? Where was ever a greater philanthropist than Abraham? And why did he not set free the slaves which the king of Egypt made him a present of? Why did Ezra not command the Babylonian exiles who were returning to their old country, had in their suit 7,337 slaves, to set their slaves free and send them away? So again, this argument that if slavery is really something that's so abhorrent, then all of these people in Tanakh, who we hold to very high standard, they would have said, they would have told people to free their slaves, and they did not. And again, seeing over here, just again, I think this distrust of the abolitionists, seeing that their motives is anti-Semitic, they're going to bring us to war. What's interesting about that rabbi was his speech, or his speeches that, you know, supported the South were seen as so successful to a certain extent that in New Orleans, a synagogue in New Orleans actually offers him a job, based on the sermons that they hear. That again, you know, he's, you know, in more in Baltimore, but this idea that, oh, if this is what you're saying, come to the South, and you can, we want to hear more of what you're saying, of what you're preaching. So again, just seeing that as an example. Another example, just again, on the pro-Southern side, source number 6, Rabbi Max Michelbacher, who was, again, another Orthodox rabbi in a congregation in Richmond, Virginia, he actually composed a tefillah for the Confederacy. And as part of the excerpt from his tefillah for the Confederacy, says a few things that we can comment on. He says, again, we approach thee, O God of Israel, not as a single meeting of a part, but as a whole congregation of all people of the land. The manservants and the maidservants thou hast given unto us. The enemy are attempting to seduce, that they too may turn against us, whom thou hast appointed over them as instructors in thy wise dispensation. So again, a few, anyone want to comment? What seems to be different things that he's mentioning over here in this tefillah, like his attitude towards the slaves, his attitudes towards what's going on? Thoughts about the language in this tefillah?
Given to us.
Given to us. Okay, so what does that mean? Given to us?
Property.
These are our property that God has given to us. I would say also it's interesting, and different scholars point this out, that he says the manservants and the maidservants. He doesn't call them slaves. He calls them servants. And there was, unfortunately, this attitude in the South, right, that the slaves... this was for their own good, right? We were, the Southern slaveholders were humanizing them. They were humanizing people who were savages, and, you know, they're not slaves, they're servants. And there's a different, you know, distinction here in the language. And this idea also that God has given them to us, they are our property. And as well, there's this fear almost in the tefillah that, you know, our slaves are happy. The enemy are trying to seduce them. It's the enemy that's trying to get them to leave. Our slaves are happy to stay with us. They're happy in their lives. You know, we're treating them well. Everything is fine. And there's this fear also that they too may turn against us. So it's this fear of slave rebellions. You know, what's going to be if, you know, we allow slavery to end? The slaves are going to rise up against us. We need to keep them controlled. We need to keep them. It's for their own good. It civilizes them. So again, a lot of unfortunate values or unfortunate, you know, approaches seen here towards slavery, but kind of couched in this tefillah. So to recap kind of what we've seen so far, and then we'll wrap this up. We've seen that in the North, right, you had these, you know, you did have the people who were the staunch abolitionists who felt it was worth going to war in order to, it was worth going to war in order to end slavery. That's the only time Jews will be safe, you know, if we're able to have a democracy where everyone is free. We did see in Raphael's argument, it seemed to be that he didn't fully understand what was going on in the South. Then we also saw that there were Southern rabbis who, again, for as part of the culture and as part of, you know, living in Southern leading states, were all right with slavery. They supported it. They tried to find these arguments in Tanakh of what the Avot did. But again, it could be they didn't fully understand how terrible slavery was. And we're couching it more in, you know, Southern rights, the rights to make their own economic choices. And again, just being part of assimilated in the South. However, there was a middle ground, which I want to point out now. The people who are a little bit in the middle, who were against slavery, but who were willing to tolerate it in order to preserve the Union. So Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss was in Cincinnati. He was a Reform rabbi in Cincinnati, had a lot of strong economic ties to the South. And he was someone who, on one hand, did not trust the abolitionists at all, but at the same time felt that the preservation of the Union has to be the strongest, has to be the most important thing that's pushing us here. And what's interesting is he felt very strongly that it was not a place, it was not his place to talk about politics. He had the this publication called The Israelite, and he refused to kind of get political. He didn't want to ever explicitly say whether he was pro-slavery or against slavery, but for him it was much more about being against the war. And he says over here, it is with utmost, this is source 7, it would utmost regret that we record the fact that thousands of our fellow citizens speaking of the dissolution of the Union, we'll skip to the bolded part, we do not know by what policy, compromise, or amendments this can be effected easiest and quickest, but we know and feel that the storm must abate and a Union must be maintained. Especially Rabbi Weiss was someone who was felt very strongly about the rights of Jews, making sure they had full emancipation in the United States, and something that would continue. And this tremendous, tremendous fear the Union would, that war would destroy this if we lost the Union. He goes on in Source 8, we are the servants of peace and not war. We'll skip to the bold part. Should we choose sides of one of the parties? We cannot. Not only because we abhor the idea of war, but also we have dear friends and near relations, beloved kinsmen in either section of the country. Therefore, silence must henceforth be our policy. And again, we see here that his fear is not just that we'll lose Jewish rights if we lose the Union, but what's going to happen if we go to civil war? What are you going to have?
Jew versus Jew.
Right? We're living all over the United States, and how could we come to this horrible situation where you're going to have Northern Jews fighting Southern Jews? Whatever we can do to avoid the situation, we must. And again, it seems, and scholars are kind of debating his position because he never explicitly comes out against slavery, but again, it could be that as much as, you know, he was against slavery, he was willing to tolerate it in order to preserve the Union. The last source I want to show was Rabbi Sabato Moraes, who was a rabbi here in Philadelphia. He also has a very interesting perspective, just to kind of use as a foil for Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss. So Rabbi Moraes was an Orthodox/traditional rabbi. He came from Italy. His father was very involved in the revolution there. His father actually spent time in prison for the revolution in Italy, which influenced his son a lot. His son goes, he's a pulpit in England for a little bit before he comes to the Mikveh Israel Synagogue here in Philadelphia. And he was someone, and we'll see from his writings, that believed very strongly in how special America was and how much he wanted to make sure the Jews' position here would be safe. But a little bit different than Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss, he felt that you had to speak out against slavery. And even though he actually got in trouble with it for his congregation, he felt he had no choice, something you had to speak out about. And we'll just see here, and what's interesting also about his sermons, so when I was researching this, his sermons were encrypted. He wrote them in shorthand, and nobody really could figure out, you know, what he was saying in his sermons. And then until recently, people came and figured and were able to decipher them. So it's really only recently that we have his sermons kind of published, because he wrote them in shorthand. But again, interesting kind of quotes from, and we see here his attitude. So in the last two sources, source 9 says, "I've stood with my mind on the summit of Pisgah to survey this land of promise, which has beckoned to this land of promise the weary and oppressed. I've been permitted to enter this new Canaan, every spot of which is sanctified by the footsteps of revolutionary heroes. I've often gazed upon the face of liberty. I've contemplated the work of that righteous founder of American greatness." So again, a huge fan here of America, calling it like the new Eretz Canaan, right, for him. That's how much he appreciates it. At the same time, "O land, O land, O land, Eretz, 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 thy prosperity has seduced thy way from the path marked out by the noble founders. Therefore hath trouble befallen thee. Generation fostered by luxury, corruption engendered by satiety has conspired against thee." And different scholars try to explain, you know, what is going on with this argument here, and it seems that, again, he is lamenting the fact that the revolution might, the war might come to hurt, you know, this American utopia for Jews that he feels so strongly about, and he puts the blame not on northern abolitionists, but on the South. And he's really saying it's their strong leanings towards the economy, their strong leanings, thinking that if we give up slavery, it's going to hurt our finances, it's going to hurt our economy, that this degeneration, this luxury, this corruption is what is bringing us to war. And it's not the fault of the North, it's the fault of the South. And he gets a sermon on Thanksgiving Day in the second last source that we'll do. He says, "Not the victories of the Union, but those of freedom, my friends, we do celebrate. What is Union without human degradation? Not I, the enfranchised slave of Mitzrayim. Cast then your vision yonder." This was part that I love. He says, "And behold, the happy change wrought by the hand of Providence. Thy name shall no longer be called Maryland, but Maryland. For thou hast verily breathed a joyous spirit into the souls of all thy inhabitants." And again, saying that, you know, it's not just for him about the Union, but it's about freedom. This is really the cause that we're fighting for, and coming out explicitly against slavery. This is when the slavery was abolished in Maryland, you know, saying now we're going to call it Maryland, and having this sense of joy and support and outspokenness when it comes to supporting or getting rid of slavery. And he actually says, it points out in a footnote in source 11, that he actually got in trouble for this at Mikveh Israel, and he says, you know, "History is connected with it. Copperheads became so enraged by reason of it that I got a hornet's nest around my ears. Men would have stopped my speaking altogether, but I appealed to my constituents, and after 3 months' silence, renewed my free speech as formerly." So even though we said before, right, that the rabbi in Baltimore ran to Philadelphia, where there he was allowed to say whatever he wants, so unfortunately Rabbi Marius got into some trouble when he started speaking out against slavery. But again, this was something that even if his congregants were somewhat, you know, a little bit on the line, he felt that, you know, unlike the other rabbis who are in the middle, this is something that we don't want to lose what we have in America, but we have to speak out against it. And that's something that he felt.
And established ATS.
Yes, and then
after that.
Yes, and right after that, right. He was someone who, again, right, he was Orthodox, he was a proponent of an opponent of reform for his whole life, and that's why, right, he was involved also in starting JTS to try to stem that tide. Okay, so what we've seen, just kind of wrap up everything, right, we saw the rabbis in the North, right, and again, the staunch abolitionists that who again feel like, you know, Jews will only be safe if we go to war. We saw the positions in the middle that felt like, no, we have to put the Union even over slavery, perhaps not fully understanding how horrible slavery was, this fear of Jew versus Jew in a civil war. We see the rabbis in the South who were very, you know, enmeshed in Southern society, not wishing for the South to have to give up any of their rights, even running tefillot for the Confederacy. And finally, we saw Rabbi Marais, who again, though he's in the middle, feels like you have to side against slavery. So I think when we think about these different sources, we see how everyone's background, religious affiliation, where they lived, lots of different things were going on to kind of influence their opinions. And it's interesting just to see the arguments that they use, especially the Orthodox versus Reform argument. Do we say times have changed? Do we not? We mentioned that this argument, even though seems to be espoused as a Reform argument in the sources, seems to a certain extent today to be something that I would say in the modern Orthodox community within limits. This is the big question, right? Where do we draw the line of when things evolve and when things not? When it comes to slavery, might be an argument that wouldn't seem out of place, you know, within an Orthodox framework, seeing that Chazal also limit things, you know, we said it was debatable with polygamy, but perhaps with polygamy, with Eshet Yafat Tohar, with different things that are also, you know, everything that's controversial in Tanakh, we kind of lump in that category of how the rabbis will phase certain things out, even Sota to a certain extent, and adding on different prohibitions. So that's kind of one approach. And just
I'm wondering if this question was put before any rabbis in Europe. Time, any like of the great post game of the time.
That's interesting. I'm not sure. It's definitely interesting to look up.
What was the question?
Was this question passed on to any of the post game in Europe at this time? Like what they thought. It's an interesting question. I don't know offhand, but something interesting now piqued my curiosity to look it up. In general, here we said this was more just the rabbis in America talking. And again, it doesn't seem to be more of tshuvot. It's
right.
More just what they thought and how they would fit that into public policy. So it's an interesting question. I'm not sure.
I would take it in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. I like the question. We have a very prominent rabbi here in Philadelphia, Marcus Jastrow. His dictionary is standing right there. He was involved in the revolution in Poland, kicked out of Poland, and came here to become a Reform rabbi. I wondered, I don't hear him here.
Right.
And he is exactly in the middle.
Right.
Where does he fit?
Right. It's a good question. There are other... I didn't see Rabbi Jasher. There are a lot of other rabbis who mentioned that. I didn't bring up just for the sake of time. It seems that in general, there was a lot of people also felt like it wasn't their place to speak about politics. They were nervous about, I think, putting their name out there. They could get in trouble with their congregation. Unclear, you know, how far this would go. But also, interesting question to see, you know, how different people came in. The one source I want to end with, and then I'm happy to, you know, to stay and answer questions, was there's an interesting article by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks who talks about this idea of slavery and how do we deal with the fact in today, you know, in modern times, Torah is something that mentions slavery, seems to sanction it to a certain extent. So he's something very interesting about this idea of God giving us a nudge. So I thought I would share it with you, and we'll see what we think about this. And he says, that is exactly what God does in the case of slavery. He does not abolish it, but he so circumscribes it that he sets in motion a process that will foreseeably, even if only after many centuries, lead people to abandon it of their own accord. And he talks a little bit about the attitude towards the Eved Ivri. And he says, you know, as we said before, how difficult it is to keep an Eved Ivri. And he says, why choose this way of doing things? Because people must freely choose to abolish slavery if they are to be free at all. God can change nature, says Maimonides, but he cannot or chooses not to change human nature precisely because Judaism is built on the principle of human freedom. So he could not abolish slavery overnight, but he could change our choice architecture, or in plain words, give us a nudge, signaling that slavery is wrong, but that we must be the ones to abolish it in our own time, through our own understanding. It took a very long time indeed, and in America, not without a civil war, but it happened. There are some issues on which God gives us a nudge, the rest is up to us. So an interesting idea, just to end with, right, from Rabbi Sacks, that this idea that perhaps God leaves it up to us. It's not a question of why does God sanction slavery, why does the Torah sanction slavery, but there are certain things that only made, you know, that for the Torah to be given in a certain historical context, it had to allow certain things, but with strict, you know, moral laws about how we would treat slaves. But it's not just enough to look in Tanakh and to say, oh, this is on the books, so we're allowed to do it. But God is trying to give us a nudge to see from how difficult it is to keep a slave that perhaps this is something that ourselves we should come to the realization that we don't want. And almost taking the question away from putting it on God and putting it on us. So an interesting perspective as well. So again, lots of things to think about when we think about how different people dealt with the issues in their time. We can think about, you know, the issues in our time, and also different controversies that go on, how we hear rebuking voices on both sides, and kind of tying into, do we think times have changed or not? So a lot of stuff to think about, and thank you so much for having me today. We'll end here. Thank you for sponsoring it, and if anyone has questions, I'm happy to stick around. Questions or not? That's fine. Also, okay.
I have a question. Yeah. Maybe I should come up and talk to you.
Sure. Either way.
Yeah. I'm just curious. It's slightly off topic, but it's on topic.
Sure.
I've been spending time this week reading about this new museum that's opened up in Alabama to commemorate lynching.
Yes.
And I read something that intrigued me, where they spoke about you cannot go to Berlin without seeing memorials for the Holocaust and reminding people of their past, and that was the only way that they could confront it in order to do that. Now is the time for America to do this. This is a step in that direction. And they juxtaposed it, which was kind of surprising.
Right.
Um,